Welcome to Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. I'm your host, Tim Friedman. Frank Oss joining me today, our fellow rock and roll expert. How are you, Frankie?
It's great to be here. Thanks.
We're going to be joining Mark Farner, our special guest from the Grand Funk Railroad. He'll be here today talking all about Grand Funk and what the process was putting songs together, how it was to work with guys like Todd Rundgren and Frank Zappa as producers.
Sure.
Hitting up in just a few minutes. As we usually do, Hall of Fame inductees now, a very eclectic group, Frankie, from 1991. Let's begin with Don Henley inducting the Byrds. What'd you think?
Wow. Byrds, terrific group. A lot of our listeners probably don't remember much about them. Maybe they remember Turn, 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 but they were a terrific group that did, yes, they did Dylan covers, but they also wrote their own stuff. And that, of course, is the group that sprang David Crosby of Crosby, Stills,
sure.
and Nash.
Turn, 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 8 Miles High.
Oh, yeah.
Roger McGuinn, Gene Clark, Chris Hillman, David Crosby, Michael Clark. They added Graham Parsons in 1968.
Fantastic stuff.
John Lee Hooker, Bonnie Raitt inducted. The blues guitarist, singer, songwriter incorporated that electric infused style of Delta blues and recorded a version of the blues song One Bourbon, One Shot, One Beer in 1966. I didn't know it went back that far. It was covered by George Thorogood many years later. The Impressions, the R&B group from Chattanooga, Tennessee. Jerry Butler, Curtis Mayfield. Albums released from 63 to 81, they released over 40 singles.
Wow.
I had no idea.
That's incredible.
It's All Right was their biggest hit, number 5 in 1963. Frankie, remember the song Mustang Sally? And Midnight Hour, Land of a Thousand Dances?
Oh, absolutely.
That is the one and only Wilson Pickett from Alabama, the fourth of 11 children. He started recording with Atlantic Records in 1965. Was teamed with famed songwriting duo of Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, Wilson Pickett.
Wow, and that's an incredible songwriting duo, too.
Jimmy Reed was introduced by ZZ Top, interesting. American blues musician, favorite of musicians who covered his songs like Steve Miller, the Yardbirds, the Stones, included several of Jimmy Reed's songs in their early set lists.
Yeah, he's one of those early influences that I would admit to not knowing too much about, but what I have found out about him is pretty exciting.
Last year, Bob Dylan paid tribute to Jimmy Reed on his 2020 album called Rough and Rowdy Ways. Phil Spector introduced Ike and Tina Turner. Now, Tina has been inducted recently, or will be anyway, in October. In the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame solo artist. She was inducted in 1991 with her ex-husband, Ike, and Rolling Stone has them at number 2 on their all-time best duos list.
Wow, and they were a fantastic duo. And of course, it's hard to disentangle the group of Ike and Tina from the marriage of Ike and Tina, but the two of them together were, in a lot of cases, magic.
Nutbush City, Proud Mary, and River Deep, Mountain High, just some of what Ike and Tina Turner put out. Congratulations to Tina Turner. She's 80 years old and getting in the Rock Hall in October.
That's fantastic.
Just a few minutes away from having Mark Farner join us, a Grand Funk Railroad founder, and we're going to talk about the Cleveland Connection. They recorded a couple of albums right downtown at Cleveland Recording Studio.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
July 5th, this day in rock history, Frankie, 1958. Ray Charles played at the Newport Jazz Festival. That must have been a good show.
Oh, yeah.
In 1968, Bill Graham, not Billy Graham, but Bill Graham, the entrepreneur, the impresario, opened the Fillmore West in San Francisco. You know, the Fillmore East he also opened, but
absolutely.
It would only stay open for a while, but it was good stuff, wasn't it?
Absolutely, and think about how many live albums got created either on Fillmore West or Fillmore East, yeah.
1969, Rolling Stones gave a free concert in London to introduce their new guitarist, Mick Taylor. It attracted 250,000 people at Hyde Park.
Wow.
2015, Grateful Dead had their final show of the Fare Thee Well shows. I don't know if that was their final show or not. Maybe it was. They've lost a few members since then, but
sure have, yeah.
Birthdays, 1943, Robbie Robertson of the band. Huey Lewis, 1951. There's a little tie-in with Bill Graham. Bill was going to see a Huey Lewis show, and on his way home, died in that tragic helicopter crash just outside of San Francisco.
That's terrible.
1959, you know, Mark Cohn, the singer, the Walkin' in Memphis, had some
absolutely
ties, you know, born in Cleveland.
Shaker Heights, I believe.
Yeah, graduated from Beechwood High School. Grammy for Best New Artist in 1992, the R&B singer Joe. He has a really cool version of This Christmas which you can listen to at Christmas time or any time. He was born on this day in 1973, and I'm a big fan of Lifehouse. You know the group, the current group Lifehouse.
Right.
Jason Wade, the lead singer, was born in 1980. Those are birthdays from July the 5th.
Wow.
Featured artist today, Frankie, Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad, guitarist, frontman, vocalist. Mark, how are you?
Hey, I'm proud to be sucking air, Brother Tim, and glad to be with you and Frankie.
It's great to have you here on Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. We've been looking forward to this for a while. 14 top 40 hits, 5 top 10s, 2 number 1s, more than 30 million records sold worldwide, 16 gold and platinum records, originally from Flint, Michigan. Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad. We have a brand new DVD that we want to promote, and it's called From Chile with Love. Mark, tell us about that.
From Chile with Love DVD was recorded a couple of years ago in Santiago, Chile. It was at a theater in the round called Teatro Caupolicán, and that theater is known for rocking. And I had been there previously, and I was looking forward to going back once we knew we were doing a South American run. We were doing some Brazil and Peru and Chile. And when the promoter called my manager, Avi, he called me, you know, Avi Steinman, says, "Hey, there's a guy down there that the promoter knows that owns Abysmal Films, and he wants to shoot an 8-camera shoot of the concert, and he wants to give us a good deal." I said, "Well, magic word, good deal, let's go." You know, good deals, let's listen to him. So we listened to him, and the guy showed us some of the stuff that he had done, and we anxiously agreed to do the video there in Santiago. And the audience showed up the same way they did the first time, and it was holding up their signs. They're so energized. This is like the American audiences are now that we've gone through this pandemic episode. They're more appreciative of the live performances, and they let us know how much they missed it. Well, in Chile, these fans are... they're Hispanic fans, you know, speaking Spanish. But, dudes, they sing the songs in American English, and some of the fans told me that they had to learn English to understand what the words to Heartbreaker meant, because the music meant so much to them, and it just shows how much music crosses language barriers, and it reaches for hearts no matter what. No matter what language the heart speaks. And this DVD shows the involvement of the band and the audience, our relationship, and how spontaneous we are to one another when we're all, you know, geeked up. And when I hit that stage, boys, I don't know if my feet ever touched the stage. I might have been floating the whole time. I was just... that good of energy. There's 16 live recording tracks there, 2 bonus videos, and 5 new songs that people have not heard before. They've never been released like this before. And we are very proud to be giving $3 from each one of these DVDs from Mark Farner's American Band from Chile with Love. $3 goes to Veterans Support Foundation. These DVDs sell for $14.99. Such a deal in the first place. But then, brothers and sisters, if you buy one of these DVDs, we're giving $3 to the Veterans Support Foundation. Thank you so much for helping us to support our brothers and sisters who risk their safety to defend ours.
Well put, Mark. Well put. So it's $14.99, the DVD. $3 of each one goes toward Veterans Support Foundation. That's great, great work there, Mark. So for Grand Funk Railroad, what were your influences when you guys were first getting together? Who did you listen to? Who was the bands or the groups that kind of guided you?
Well, I really got into the Yardbirds with Jeff Beck. And, of course, Hendrix, man, Hendrix was my guitar god. And Clapton on Fresh Cream, but only on Fresh Cream, because that's the only album that those guys released that had that kick-ass, ballsy sound. And I don't know why they would have turned away from it, but a lot of bands do. I really liked Fresh Cream. After that, I didn't care much for any of the stuff.
How did the band get together, Mark?
Well, Don Brewer, the drummer, and I were in a band called the Fabulous Pack. We had gone out to Cape Cod to staying in summer cottages on a beach, and we were doing some gigs in the Boston area, and the promoter of these gigs let us stay in his little houses out on the Cape in East Sandwich, Massachusetts. It was a great little spot until it snowed. They had the worst snowstorm in the century, and it dumped on us. So here we are, these guys from Michigan who had never seen the ocean before. We went down on the beach. Brothers, we are picking up starfish and shells and all this stuff we're going to take back, to Michigan with us when we drive back. And then after this snowstorm hit and all the rain and everything flooded the little crawl space below these cottages, and that's where all the shells were that we had been collecting. So they were frozen into the ice, and they stayed there when we left the Cape because everything was still frozen. We were there for 2 weeks without any, nobody came because you couldn't travel. You couldn't get across the bridge. The roads were blocked. And the guy at the East Sandwich grocery store there gave us oatmeal. And that's all we had was oatmeal. And we had to melt down the snow because the pipes had frozen. There was no toilets to flush because the pipes were frozen. So we had an old chair that didn't have a seat in it, and we would line one of these grocery bags with plastic and do our thing in there and then roll it up and go out and stick it in a snowbank. And so I would have hated to have been the guy who was doing spring cleanup, I'll tell you that, brothers. And they would have had some surprises. But anyways, Don Brewer finally gets a hold of his mother, who Western Union some cash to us, and we end up thumbing a ride up the coast to this drugstore where we got the cash. And then we, of course, went on, rented a van, took our stuff back to Michigan. And the two guys that were married in the band, the keyboard player, Craig Frost, and Kenny Rich, the guitar player out of Ontario, Canada, their wives threatened to divorce them. And they made them quit the band. So Brewer and I put our heads together and said, look, we can't have anybody that even has a girlfriend with influence over them. We can't have anybody that's married, that is for sure. But I said, why don't we just do a three-piece? You know, it'd be so much easier, and we won't have any of these problems, you know. And he says, well, who will we get for bass? I said, I don't know, but it'll have to be somebody badass and somebody from, you know, Michigan, somebody that we know. But we'll find them. You know, I said, God will bring them to us. And when we got back to Michigan, we wanted to go up to Delta Promotions, which is the outfit that was sending us from Michigan. They had made the deal with the promoter in Boston to do these gigs, and they told us, you got to go do these gigs, and you're going to play these gigs for free. And then the next time when we go in there, because you guys will have made this noise, we can actually, you know, make some good money. So we went thinking that, you know, that's the game. We're going to do this, and it's just promotional. We didn't know that we were actually getting paid, and somebody else was pocketing the money. But that happens to young bands. It really does. But we were going to give these guys a piece of our mind and find out what the hell happened to our cash. So we go to Bay City, Michigan, to Delta Promotions, and we're sitting there in the waiting room. And Delta Promotions was a rehearsal facility. It was a recording facility. They had booked bands out of there. And it was, you know, it was an establishment that had been there a while. And they had a band in there rehearsing, but while we were sitting out in the waiting room, I'm thinking, man, whoever's playing bass in that band is kicking ass. And they took a little break. It was Question Mark and the Mysterians who were in rehearsing. And when Mel Shocker walked out, I said, Melvin, because Mel and I went to school together. We rode dirt bikes together. We smoked pot together. We did everything together. And I said, dude, we are starting a three-piece band, and I want to know if you want to try out, and let's see if we can do a three-piece thing. He says, oh, man, Father, you guys hit here at the right time. These guys, they're, like, ready to fire me. Or, you know, there was something happened in the band. And so we started the very next week at the Flint Federation of Musicians on Averill Street in Flint, Michigan, and that's how the band started. Put that three-piece together, and Frank Geyer, the guy who was the secretary at the union, every 5 minutes he's coming out going, you boys, turn them damn things down. We can't even hear the phones ring.
How did the name Grand Funk Railroad come about, Mark?
Terry Knight, our first manager, was also a songwriter. He had written a song called Grand Funk Railroad, which was a play off of an actual railway system that runs through Ontario, Canada, Michigan, and Ohio called Grand Trunk and Western. So it was just a play from Grand Trunk and Western, and he says to the band one day, he says, well, why don't you guys call your band the name of my song, Grand Funk Railroad? And we all kind of looked at each other and went, that's cool, you know, that's it.
So you made your way down to Cleveland for a couple of albums that you recorded in the early 70s at the Cleveland Recording Studio. What was that like? My wife's uncle was a partner in Cleveland Recording back in the day.
Is that right?
So what was it like working in Cleveland at the recording studio there?
It was fantastic because we have a love for Cleveland, being that we would play the Upbeat Show on Channel 5 in Cleveland, stay at the Versailles Hotel, which was, you know, across the street. And when we'd play, and we would do Otto's Grotto in the basement of the Statler Hilton, you know, we played all around with the Cleveland area. And people just loved us. And you know, we knew that it's going to be good because we got a good vibe about Cleveland. And then when we got there and found out we had to put all our stuff on this elevator that goes down from the sidewalk and then, you know, go down and load in. And it was fun because we'd never done anything like that. Here we are, you know, 19-year-old kids going in a recording studio. We're going to put down some music. And then when we met Don, you know, he had every microphone, all of these old classic microphones, and instead of adding EQ on the board and adding, you know, sound to the noise floor, he would pick the right microphone for the instrument, for the, you know, and he knew his stuff. And we were recording on like a 8-track Scully, you know. And, but that was big time, you know, recording back then. 8-track, holy crap, man.
How did the song Closer to Home come about?
The song came about after a prayer. I always say my Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep prayers that my mother taught us six kids. And I put a P.S. on the end of my prayer, and I asked God to give me a song that would touch the hearts of those that the Creator wanted to get to. And I got up in the middle of the night. I sat up. I didn't get up. I just kind of rolled up into a sitting position. I always have a steno pad right next to my bed to write things down, because I've lost the best songs, you guys. I've lost those things, thinking, oh, I'll remember it in the morning. Nope, no way. I lost the best ones, and I'm sorry to say that. But when I started putting the legal pad next to my bed with a pen. I captured a lot. Well, I didn't know that this was a song when I'm writing it, because in my state of mind, I was halfway between heaven and earth in my mental state. And as I start writing, I knew that I couldn't go back to the top and reread it and go on from there. I had to just press forward with whatever these words were. And they just flowed right to the end, and I stayed in that state of consciousness that's halfway between heaven and earth, and this song came out. But I didn't know it was a song, because it didn't even dawn on me, the prayer that I prayed in asking God for the song. It didn't dawn on me in this state of mind, because it was just me rolling up and writing something like I'd done many nights before. But I got up in the morning, went out, made my coffee, and I'm walking, you know, through the kitchen. I grabbed my George Washburn flat top acoustic guitar, and I sat down and I started playing this. I'm like, wow, that's a pretty cool lick. And then I grabbed this inversion of a C chord that just had a chime to it that was a magic chime to my ears. And I looked down at my hand in amazement, thinking, where the hell did this thing come from? Where did that chord come from? I love that chord. And I'm studying my finger position so I won't forget. And I'm even marking it down on paper, you guys. I'm like saying, oh, my God, this is really good. But as I'm going through this, I think, oh, those words in the other room, maybe that is a song. And so I go and grab the legal pad, put it on the table, and I start playing it and start singing. And it all just came out, and I hit the cassette recorder to capture it, and it came out. I played the whole thing, and I took it to rehearsal that day, and both Don and Mel said to me, Farner, man, that song is a hit. And they were right, but I wanted to tell you guys that from Channel 5, the Upbeat show, there was Tommy Baker was the band leader, and Tommy Baker heard me playing this song. I was showing it to someone, and he came over and said, Farner, what is that song you're playing? I said, it's what we're going to record over at Cleveland Recording. And I told him, it's Closer to Home, I'm Your Captain. He said, oh, my God, he says, you can't believe my mind is going crazy. Keep playing that song just a little bit. So I did the refrain, you know, Closer to My Home. He says, when you get to the end of that song, stretch it out. And he says, and keep stretching it and stretching it and stretching it. I'm hearing stuff that's amazing. You got to give me this room to play this stuff out. So we're in the studio going and going and going, and my fingers are ready to fall off on this tune. And he says, and when you get to that place where your fingers are ready to fall off, give me 10 more bars. So we gave him everything we had. And Tommy Baker and the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra laid down all the orchestration, and that is the genius of his creation added to my song. And I think it just really pushed it over the top. And I always have to mention Brother Tommy Baker, because I don't know where he's at in the world, if he's still sucking air. But I sure love him, and I sure love the influence he had on this music.
I love that song. It's a great song. Frankie, what'd you have?
The first live album I ever bought, I'm proud to say, was Grand Funk Live. The intro to that thing is incredible. You're at the Atlanta Pop Festival with like 35 other bands, and you guys were introduced as, here's the group you've been waiting to see. What was that like?
It was, the goosebumps just came to me when you said, here's the group you've been waiting to see, because it's still in me. It's still an imprint in my brain, and because it's such a highlight of my entire life, I get very emotionally enthusiastic, just thinking back on that and thinking of the reaction of the audience, especially at that first Atlanta Pop Festival when we didn't have a record deal. These people had never heard of Grand Funk Railroad. The guy couldn't even introduce us properly. He couldn't say Grand Funk Railroad. He said everything but Grand Funk Railroad. But when we got on the stage And it was one of those deals where Terry Knight, our manager Terry Knight, his attorneys in New York City were doing the legal work for this pop festival in Atlanta, Georgia. So they made a deal with the promoters that if they would put Grand Funk Railroad on first, that they would play for free, and we did. We played for free and opened the festival, and that these the attorneys would take a reduced legal rate. So that's how we got on there in the first place. But before we could see the audience, we were just peeking out through the fence and backstage and looking at the maybe first 5-10 rows. That's all you could see of people, but you could hear, wow, this is a massive crowd. But when I got up on those steps to walk out on stage, now I'm 15 feet above people's head, and I'm looking out at a sea of people. I am talking people to the horizons. 185,000 people, that's a lot of folks.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my. But the downbeat, the whole thing, it seemed like it lasted 5 minutes. That's how geeked I was and how excited I was. And we did the first album. Those songs that those people heard that day, they ended up buying later on the album On Time, minus our encore song, which was Land of a Thousand Dances, the Wilson Pickett style.
Sure.
And if you can imagine, three-piece band doing Wilson Pickett, and I take my guitar off. Now it's just two instruments, the drums and the bass, and I'm singing and I'm doing this dance, and I'm so sweaty because it's 110 degrees in the shade in Atlanta, Georgia. It's hotter than a sheriff's pistol, and my brand-new $50 paisley print shirt was sticking to my body, and it was hanging me up. And I got to the point where I just couldn't take it anymore, and I ripped that shirt off, and that audience went nuts. I said, that worked. That worked. So I adopted that shirtless stature early on.
Did you want to play Woodstock? It was just a month later.
Well, we didn't even know about Woodstock till after it happened, but we had done the Texas International in Louisville, Texas, and some other big festivals. And that's how Grand Funk really got its start, was the festivals, because the people in Atlanta, Georgia were not all from Atlanta. They were from every state in the Union and from Canada and some from South America as well. A lot of people showed up there, and the word went out. Even though we didn't have a record deal, by the time we put our first record out, we had been doing these festivals, and people were ready to buy. And they showed by pushing our records to gold and then platinum, of course.
You know, I think of you, Mark Farner, as the voice of Grand Funk, but songs like We're an American Band and Shining On, suddenly Don Brewer is the lead singer. How did that come about?
Well, when I would write some music, you know, I'd be making chords, whatever, making a progression, and Brewer would come over and say, like on Shining On, he said, have you got anything written for that? I said, no, man, I'm just now getting the lick. He says, well, I'm hearing something. I said, well, write some words. If you got words, write some words.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how it would always happen, except with American Band. Lynn Goldsmith, our publicist, but she was actually more of a co-manager because she had more to do with the success of Grand Funk than any publicist would have. Because of her creativity, her wanting to put the American Band album out there, yellow vinyl, you know, a gold vinyl, and we could then advertise that we're shipping it gold, which was that was our ad campaign, and so people thought, wow, this is gold already. Yeah, it's yellow vinyl, but there was 100,000 of the yellow vinyl albums out of the millions that were sold, and 100,000 of the singles, American Band with Creepin' on the reverse side. But when Brewer came in, after Lynn Goldsmith prompted us by saying, why don't you guys write a song about what you are, an American band? Well, Brewer comes with the lyrics to rehearsal, and I come up with these chord changes. After he plays a little two-note chord thing on a guitar, showing basic structure of what he was thinking. Well, then I took it, you know, to the what it was on the record, but I said, dude, this song needs a cowbell. And he says, well, I don't have a cowbell. I said, you don't have a cowbell? Are you crazy, man? You're a drummer. You need a cowbell. And he says, well, listen, I'll stop and pick one up tomorrow on the way to rehearsal. I said, no, man, pick up six, and we'll pick the best one that matches the chord that we're playing, and we'll get something that's really a, it doesn't go tink, tink, tink. It goes kank, kank, kank. Mm-hmm. And so, and that cowbell, by the way, was voted, that song, number two out of the top 10 cowbell songs ever recorded and by Rolling Stone magazine, rated at number two, only superseded by Honky Tonk Women. Okay. So I think the cowbell was an important part, and that drum lick on the intro, that's my drum lick. I taught that to Don Brewer. I could hear it in my head. I said, it's got to start like this. It's got to start like a train taking off, you know, boom.
I'll tell you one guy, Mark, who really likes you and recently paid you a very nice compliment about your work at Criteria Studios and that song, We're an American Band, and the album in particular, Todd Rundgren, who produced it. He said that, and he was a legendary producer even at that time, you guys were ready to go when you got there. You were tight. You knew what you were going to lay down that day. And We're an American Band, the single, came out before the album was even done. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes.
Tell me about working with Todd Rundgren.
Well, Todd is, in my opinion, he's a musical genius. People think he's a nutball or whatever. He's always goofing around. That is his normal state of mind. He is that guy. And he's never allowed himself to grow up, you know? And I love that about him. Because everything is so easy to him. He doesn't have to really work hard at what he does, brothers. He just does it. And one thing when I wanted to mention, when I went in and I was listening to a playback, and Rundgren's sitting there at the console in the control room at Criteria, and I said, Todd, could you add a little, like, 3.5 kilohertz to that guitar in the right channel? It's not quite cutting through there, and it needs... And he said, okay, Mark, let me show you something. Instead of adding that 3.5 kilohertz, he says, let's duck these other frequencies around it so that it sticks out more. He says, if you add to your mix, you add on a frequency, you're going to add noise. And all of that is going to accumulate. So what you need to do is start from zero and duck the frequencies that are interfering with you hearing the one that you want to hear. And I went, bingo. The light went on. I went, oh, man, what a great tip. What a great tip. And I've been using it ever since.
So Todd also produced Shining On, did he not?
Oh, yes, he did.
Yeah, you moved on to other producers as well, too, didn't you?
We had Jimmy Einer. That did Some Kind of Wonderful, Bad Time to Be in Love. We had Frank Zappa, of course. Zappa was a blast to work with.
When you had a number one song or two, how hard was it to follow up on that, especially with the touring? And...
Well, it was not hard because we never let that stuff into what we were doing. What we were doing was live performances, and the recording was just on the side. Our heads were wrapped around that stage, and we just happened to put out albums in between. And some of those albums, I'm not kidding you, we did, I think it was E Pluribus Funk, we did in 3 days, complete albums with a mix. Crazy.
You just love performing on the road, don't you? You still do, but you did back then, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do, and it's part of who I am, and I am who my songs say I am. When I show up on stage, people know what they're going to get.
It's no secret that back in the day, the rock media was very harsh in their treatment of Grand Funk. What was the group's reaction to what was quite often, I would say, unfair criticism?
Well, I think because we would hear some of that stuff and go, man, what show was that cat at? He wasn't at our show. And I think that part of that whole stigma was created by Terry Knight when he told us, you know, and we're just young kids, my mother had to sign the contract between us and Goodnight Production, Terry's company, because I was not, I wasn't 21. I was a 20-year-old kid at the time. So we were just more into that music and creating it, you know, for the stage, and rolling with it. It was more of rather than a realization for the three guys. It was, we were riding the wake of this big wave. I'm telling you, we were all on boards, headed for stardom, and we were standing up tall on those boards and riding it out. But that's our young imagination and the energy that we had, and the love that came from the songs, because people recognize when you're speaking from your heart, and a lot of the songs that really resonate and that people holler out for when we're on stage and we give them to them, they come from the heart, and they're a challenge to what is accepted. And especially back in the days when I wrote "People, Let's Stop the War," the people didn't want to play that, you know. But the audience wanted to hear it, and we still have it in the set today when I go out and play. So the music is still at work, and the love is still at work.
Back in the 70s, there's so much great rock and roll, so many artists. Did you have any friendly rivalries going on between you and other bands, other acts?
Not really, because we were headlining right out of the chute. You know, we went out and when we play these big pop festivals, it was with other name artists. But I met Janis Joplin. I became very good friends with Janis. And Jimi Hendrix, very good friends with Jimi. But it was no rivalry. I just admired these people. And the relationship that I had was based on my admiration. I never puffed myself up thinking, oh, I'm going to be better than, or we're going to be better than these guys. It wasn't about being better. It was about being ourselves and going out and showing people what Flint, Michigan had kicked out of the chute. And that was our assembly line, blue-collar assembly line rock and roll.
You sing lead and also play lead guitar, which is incredible to me. How difficult is it to do both on stage?
Well, I'm going to tell you something. I was having a really hard time with that. And I went to my Uncle Woody's house, and he was a musician. My family on my mother's side moved up to Flint, Michigan from Leechville, Arkansas. And I'm talking the whole family, grandpas, grandmas, uncles, aunts, everybody moved north to get jobs in the auto factories. Sure. So, and every Sunday we'd have jam sessions either at my house, my mother's house, or my Aunt Dorothy's house, her sister. And everybody'd show up with their fiddles, banjos, guitars. My dad blew saxophone, and all the women sang. And it was the most beautiful music. I wish I could have recorded it and had it to play for you guys, because it was beautiful. But Uncle Woody told me, he says, I'll help you out with that, Mark. Because I told him, I said, I know the rhythm. I can play this rhythm. But then when I start to sing, it's like it just stops. He says, here, sit down at my dining room table. I'm going to show you something. So I sat across the table. He puts a newspaper across the table from me, so I have to read it upside down and backwards. And he says, I want you to read this. And I'm going, holy crap, man, are you kidding me? And I start. He said, just the large print. I'm not talking about the whole paper. He says, but just sit here, read the large print, and turn the page. He says, you'll get faster as you turn the page. You'll see, you'll start to adapt to reading upside down and backwards. He says, this is going to help you. So I did it. And what it does is it uses your right and left hemisphere simultaneously. So, and that's what you have to do in order to sing one rhythm and play another. And when I got done with the paper, I went through it twice. He had me, and it took me about an hour. And I said, well, okay, I've got that down. I'm pretty fast at it now. I said, that second time through reading that paper kind of went pretty quick. He says, good. He says, now sit there in the chair. I'm going to grab my Gibson. So he goes and gets his J45. He says, now play that song. And so I sit down and I start playing Nadine and singing Nadine, and it was just like, oh my God, I can do this now. Thank you, Uncle Woody. I can do this. And so I've been doing that ever since. And even driving down the road, and you look in the rearview mirror and you see words that are backwards, I can read them words, boom. But that's what helped me. And I tell you that without that, I don't know if I would have ever gotten over that hurdle. But with the help of my Uncle Woody, and I'm passing this on to you guys and the listeners, this is how you get past it. And you can sing one rhythm and play a different rhythm.
As we wrap things up on Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations featuring rock and roll expert Frank Oz talking to Mark Farner, Grand Funk Railroad, Mark Farner's American band, back on the road, are they not?
Yes, we are. We're back on the road. We've played four or five shows already, some with Blue Oyster Cult down in St. Augustine, Florida, a couple of weeks ago. People are eating it up because the audiences are so ready to hear live music, so ready to be back in the embrace, because it's an emotional fix for not only the band, it's for the audience. I mean, everybody gets a fix when our mind is on having a good time and letting the music lead the way back to the memories when we first heard that music, you know, decades ago. And it is working like magic. It's a reinstated love and a wake up, it seems, to what had become quite fickle. The audiences are in the United States have got, you know, all this music, but in other countries when I play, it's not that fickle state of mind, and they always show that appreciation. Well, the Americans that we have been playing for this year have got that fresh look and that fresh adventure in their eyes, and it feels good. And we, because everything that I sell, my T-shirts, hats, everything on my website I take to the show is made in the United States. I won't sell anything with my name on it that's foreign made. I want to support my country, and I'm trying to show people how to do it, and they really appreciate that. Yeah, it costs a little more, but it's, you know, what is freedom worth? Is it worth a little more? You're damn right.
We'll put the link to your website up on Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations Facebook page, as well as information about how to get the new concert DVD from Chile with Love that's out now. $3 from every DVD goes toward Veterans Support Foundation. Legendary career. We'd love to see you in Cleveland. Are you planning on perhaps coming up here with Mark Farner's American band?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know, because I never look at the website to see where we're playing next. My wife takes care of all that. I never know where we're going. I just know the day we're leaving.
It's been great talking with you, Mark. Thanks so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Brother Tim and Frank. Been a ball being with you guys.
Thank you for the music, sir.
Thank you. God bless you guys. Rock 'em alive.
You can find out all about the new DVD, Live from Chile, with Mark Farner's American Band. Just go to markfarner.com, tour dates, and some gear you can purchase and more. We certainly hope you enjoyed our conversation with Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad. Hope to see him up in Cleveland very soon. See you back here next week when we interview Tim Doherty, the Rock and Roll Authority, longtime air personality and program director from WONE 97.5, the home of rock and roll in Akron, and talk to him about his career in radio and also something he knows a lot about, the group Led Zeppelin. For Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad and Mark Farner's American Band, and Frank Ost, our rock and roll expert, I'm Tim Friedman. We'll see you next time on Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations.